Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Vacationing somewhere in South Africa. Answering your questions. And a few tips and tricks to boot. All this and much more on episode number 623 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you. This is Andrew Horowitz. And yeah, I'm not really here right now. And well, I thought it would be an interesting idea to provide you some listening pleasure while I'm out somewhere. I mean, right now, as you're listening to this at this moment, if it's somewhere in the week of, let's say, August 1st through the 15th, I am either sipping some delicious wines at the vineyards and the wine country in South Africa outside of Cape Town, or I am perilously close to a wild rhinoceros. I mean, one of the two. Well, I could be sleeping, I guess, too. But I am in South Africa right at the time, and I thought what we'd do is instead of a traditional podcast that we do here where we have a guest and we talk about the markets and all that, I thought that would be a good idea for a listener questions episode. Everybody loves listener questions. Everybody loves getting their questions answered. And we got several that we went through and thought would be appropriate and interesting for everybody to hear. And those that I did not get to on the show, I probably answered you back directly through email, whether it was something that was kind of a repeat of another question that came in or maybe something too personal. Of course, you could always go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you could simply click on the Ask Andrew button right at the top of the page of the homepage and ask any question that you want on any topic you want. And I will do my best to answer it either on the show or directly. So thanks, everybody, for providing your questions and the information. A couple of things I want to mention before we get there and get to some of these questions, some good stuff here. There was the last few shows, I think, have been pretty interesting. I mentioned, and a lot of you have taken advantage of, Investology, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. Of course, this is what we do. This is our bread and butter. We manage money. We're investment advisors and financial planners. The whole gamut of the area of money and finance and investing, that's what we do here at Horowitz & Company. So if you have any interest in working with us, yes, the door is open. We are open for business. So if you want to find out more about any of the strategies at all, you want to set up a time to talk, you can just go over to the site, do the contact us, maybe even the TDI Ask Andrew, whatever you want to do, get in touch with me. We'll spend some time. There's some great information on all of the different strategies on the website, as well as a video, we'll call it a walkthrough, a virtual tour of some of the basic components of the managed growth strategy that you can find out more about as well. And this is our long-short strategy. And then Investology has plenty of information about how we manage, why we manage, who we manage with, what we're doing, what we hold in the portfolio. That's the advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced, robo-esque strategy that we put together because you asked us to do so. So check all those out. I think that you'll find them most interesting, as well as, of course, for our clients that have a larger need for larger amounts of assets to be managed. We have our global allocations, which is what we started with way back 1990-something. And that was the core strategies that we developed here that everybody that came in at that time would be utilizing. And this is for 500,000 or more of assets. If you're in that area of assets to be managed, let us take a look at what you're doing. Let us take a look at your current portfolio and compare it against kind of what we see. Maybe there is some holes in your diversification or possibly some areas that you could save some money on management fees or even looking at long-term performance and management tenure and all that. So just maybe just take advantage of that. I'm offering it to you, so something that you can consider utilizing. So we have questions. We have a number of questions. And no particular order on these. I'm just going to start banging through these. And our first question comes in from Tim. Tim from Wisconsin. And Tim writes, he says, thanks for taking my question. In the past, you talked about the benefits of mutual funds over ETFs. But doesn't that high cost of the mutual funds usually outweigh the benefits? I must have missed something. All right, Tim. So actually, if you look over on and you search on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, there's an article we wrote on and a study that we did on the differential and benefits or detractions of mutual funds versus ETFs. Now, we used a universe in there primarily of fixed income because, yeah, just to get back to your point here, if you have higher costs and all things are equal inside of mutual fund or an ETF, well, obviously, the ETF probably makes a lot more sense. However, it doesn't make sense all the time just because you're getting a lower cost. I mean, I use the example all the time. You know, if I was to say to you, listen, I'll give you an ETF that has done an average of 10% a year and the cost factor of it is 0.25%, like nothing, right? Very low cost overall. The net return is 10%. And there's some manager out there, I don't know who, magical, made up, some manager that's giving 30% a year net, but they charge you 10% per year. Again, totally made up. What would you choose? Well, a lot of people would say, well, I'm going to use the ETF because it's lower cost. I mean, think about it for a second, right? What we're looking for is risk-adjusted performance, also risk-adjusted against fees, net performance and risk-adjusted, all that. But at the same time, at the end of the day, when you're looking down at your portfolio, you're looking at the results over time, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it's not necessarily about the fees that you paid, it's the net results that you received after the fees. So where we see the use, and a really good use case for ETFs, are efficient markets and those that are postured and put against markets that have really good liquidity, transparency, and where a manager trying to beat that index just doesn't work. So things like U.S. equities, large cap, very much a market that you would consider efficient. Small caps to a lesser degree, but okay, that's fine. Certain areas in the area of bonds, on the other hand, totally different situation. Take, for example, emerging market bonds. Do you want to be in an ETF if there's one out there, or do you want to be in a mutual fund? Well, less transparency, less efficiency, less liquidity. There are language barriers, there are currency barriers and issues that are different from each other when you're trading them country by country. There's also the problem that you have with regard to political issues. So all these different things lead us to believe that it would be probably better to be in a mutual fund where you can have boots on the ground, so to speak, and you can have people out there actively understanding what's happening in those particular markets. And when we did that study, what we found was what we thought we'd find. Generally speaking, inefficient markets in the bond area that you use either mutual funds or ETFs, the mutual funds usually beat out net after fees the returns. You can see it. It's right there. All the specs and all the stats are on the site. The study proves it out pretty well. So just thinking that you should be investing in an ETF because it's much more cost effective is really good. And that's a great idea. And we subscribe to that 100% in those markets that it makes sense to do so. Now, I know this is a little bit of a longer answer than you probably were thinking, but I think it bears the need to talk about this because a lot of people are getting, I would say, brainwashed with the idea that an ETF is the only way to go. Now, there are some advantages of ETFs. For example, you could trade them intraday. Okay, that's great. But when you're setting up a portfolio for the long haul, probably not that interested in the day-to-day, minute-by-minute underlying movement of that particular fund. So if you're setting up a diversified long-term portfolio And what you want to find is those managers of whether it's an ETF or a fund that meet the criteria that you're looking for in that particular sector, and then understand more about the sector and what's happening in terms of liquidity, transparency, efficiency. So it all depends, Tim, on really what sector. That's the main ingredient in this whole thing, and understanding what you're investing in, not just all about the cost. Sometimes the higher cost pays off in the long run, because maybe what's happening is that you're not necessarily involved in an area that's having a lot of trouble just because it matches the index. And there's another thing that I think is really important too. I think there's something to be said here about this. When you have a manager on a mutual fund, particularly in a bond mutual fund, versus an ETF that's a bond ETF, the ETFs will be forced to sell and rebalance, possibly at very inopportune times. Now, when that happens, who's the buyer? It's possible that the mutual fund companies and the managers there find these aberrations in prices because of forced selling and can actually get you a much better deal on buying some of the positions inside of that portfolio. And when that happens, you get the benefit as the owner of that fund. So it covers a lot of area there, but I do believe that if you do look at the report, it's under the journal area, I believe it is, in the blog area of the site. You can find it, just kind of poke around, and you'll find that article. We wrote that about 3 months ago, but I think it was really good. You know, I'll try to retweet that sometime this week. Let me write that down. Retweet the article. So just look at my Twitter feed, which is Andrew Horowitz, one word, and you'll find that. Kind of a long answer to a short question. Sorry about that. Next question comes from Audrey G. She's a great show, loyal listener. I listen to many financial podcasts, and just about everyone is negative on the economy, some more than others. But how does the stock market keep going up with all the negative news? Doesn't the economy have an impact on the stock market? First of all, we could look at a variety of biases here. And you have to wonder, Audrey, if you're listening to podcasts that agree with your current outlook and sentiment. In other words, is there a confirmation bias that you're listening to these various podcasts because they share your thoughts? In other words, if there was another podcast that was really positive or talked about things that maybe you didn't agree with, would that be something that you would listen to? And is that why many of the podcasts that you're currently listening to all sound the same? But to your question, let's talk about this. So yes, the economy does have an incredible impact on the stock market, but it doesn't have to be timed exactly with the stock market moves. In other words, if we're finding that there is a drop in the stock market that doesn't have any economic reasoning, that may be due to other factors. It could be war. It could be earnings related. It could be a single stock that something happens, a shock somewhere in the world. On the other side, if you see that economics are starting to change a bit, it doesn't always flow down. The stocks are lagging because what we're talking about is earnings. So if we're seeing a slowing economy, for example, and stocks aren't reacting, it may be that it's going to take 3 to 6 months for all of that economic data to really pour into the stocks. At the same time, let's also agree to this. The Fed has been managing the markets and expectations for interest rates, trying to get ahead of any kind of economic slowdown in order to ensure the stock market doesn't go down. Because if the stock market goes down, that could exacerbate any kind of economic downturn. Confidence drops, spending drops, and all of a sudden you're in a situation where, whew, not only is the economy dropping because of all the outside economic issues that are going on, maybe around the world that are now impacting us here, but all of a sudden you get a confidence drop, and that just slows down the economy even further. So now, I think the answer to your question is that now, with such an incredible amount of central bank management of the economies and moving around interest rates on a regular basis, the communications policy, the White House and administration that we have currently so focused in on the markets and probably more importantly, the very quick flow of information back and forth from companies in real time to analysts is creating a bit of a feedback loop of positive information. We also have a lot of other outside influences on the markets that right now are allowing for us to say, as we said, I think in the last show or the show before, the data doesn't matter. Because there's a lot of these outside influences that are really impacting what is happening with the mechanics of the market. But I think in the long haul, to answer your question, yes, the economy does have an important part of where stock prices are. And I'll share this one interesting point with you. For our TDI managed growth strategy, what we do is a filtering and screening. There's actually a question coming up about this. Somebody wrote in about filtering and screening. But we do a filtering and screening quantitative process on finding stocks for our core equity selection inside the portfolio. We start with about 5,000 stocks. We go through this whole process. And we look at things like growth of revenue, growth of EPS. We see margin expansion. We see ROE. We see, you know, several different fundamental and other data points that are relative to what we believe is a quality stock that should do well in various market conditions. Okay, so that's the case. What's interesting to note is that over the last 6 months, the number of stocks that have actually made it through that screen have dropped from about 60 down to, I just did it a couple days ago, down to about 26. What does that mean? Well, that means that even though companies are beating estimates, and everybody's, you know, looking at this as, hey, this is great, pushing stock markets to an all-time high, there's something fundamentally that isn't working. There's a problem. Companies are actually not growing their revenues. They're not growing their EPS, or something else is going on that is causing these stocks to drop off our screen. And that is telling us something, because I haven't seen that kind of drop down, I think, once in the last 4 years, 5 years. And when that happened, it was about 3 months later that things really got crazy in markets. So there is a delayed effect of the markets and the economic cycle. And right now, there's such high confidence, generally speaking, and this overly bullish attitude for stocks that, you know, things are going to get better. We're going to get, you know, a rate cut. We're going to see that the China situation is going to resolve and, you know, the Fed here is going to do a lot. The central bank in Europe is going to do a lot. And China is going to turn around. And everything's, you know, everybody's seeing the glass as, you know, three quarters of the way full. All these other issues are just noise. But stay on your toes, because the economy does matter. This one, all right, next question. Next question, I was asked not to mention the name. So the question is, I'm confused about something. I want to save for my retirement looking at a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. How do I determine which is a better option? That's the whole question. That's it. So I don't have a lot to go with here, but what I want to tell you is that you have to look at things like, hey, what's my age? How long is it going to be till I retire? What's my tax outlook? You know, what is my tax going to be now into the future, the next few years, and maybe in, I don't know how old you are, but 30 years from now? What's your employment situation? Is this a 401k, an IRA? Do you have that? You know, what is going on with exactly how this is measured? What are the other retirement plans that you have? One of the things you could do to solve some of these problems and get an answer that's relatively good, there's all these IRA calculators. You can look them up. It's Roth versus IRA. There's 100 of them out there. And basically, you can then put in all this data, look at exactly what the differences are utilizing different scenarios, and come up with an educated result, an answer that is appropriate for you. I will say this. Essentially, when you look at this, and every time I've done these, the younger you are, oftentimes the results will show that a Roth IRA is probably a better way to go. However, it depends on a ton of other factors as well. For example, you're young. You have no retirement plans other than what you're going to fund here. Maybe you're a consultant and you don't have any taxable write-offs of any substance. You don't have any substantial tax write-offs and you need a write-off to kind of bring your taxes down. And this would be a good option for you to go into a traditional versus a Roth. Again, it all depends on just so many different factors. Go find yourself a really good, no name. Hello, no name. Go find yourself a really good calculator and figure out which one's better. This next question is from Bailey R. What is up with the Fed? What is up with the Fed? You had Danielle DiMartino Booth on not too long ago. Parentheses, she needs to come back on and explain the Fed's current stance. Great guest, end parentheses. But it seems that they are off the rails. Why are they considering dropping rates? Is the economy, if the economy is doing so well? We talked about this so many times in terms of it looks like this is what they're calling and they'd like to, you know, they want to frame this as an insurance cut. The rest of the world is slowing down. Our yield curve is bonkers. The trade dispute is a problem. And moreover, right now, we're seeing that they have the ability to do so because they see that inflation is not ticking up. The economy is slowing down a bit. They want to get ahead of things and make sure that they're in good shape. But the problem is by mandate, we know that they want to look at a stable employment situation. We have 3.8% unemployment, which is very good. They want to see inflation higher. We're close to 2%, close enough to really say that you wonder why they're, I agree with you, by the way, Bailey, we're wondering ourselves, well, what is this all about? Stock markets at all-time highs and all that. I think they are backed up into a corner right now. I guess that's the best way to describe this, that if they don't do so, the dollar's going to go higher. The problem is that that would hurt even further some of the things that are going on. It's also in reaction to what's happening around the world. Easing by the Fed will help the rest of the world as well. And that then comes back to us in the form of economic growth, because if they're doing well, we're doing well and vice versa. So I think what's happening really here is they're being forced to do so. And Fed fund futures are predicting this. They have no risk. Markets are expecting it. So they're kind of thinking that this is the way to go. Anyway, Bailey, thanks for your question on that. We did talk about that a few times, so I just want to touch on that very quickly. Next question comes from, I think this is how you pronounce it, Magna L. Hi, Andrew. I'm a longtime listener, so thanks for doing the podcast every year, every week. Not every year, every week. What's your take on Brexit now that Boris Johnson is prime minister? Is there a good way to play the market before the current deadline of October 31st? Oh. Here's the problem. This whole Brexit shenanigans and whether they're going to do a hard Brexit or no deal Brexit or deal Brexit or semi-deal Brexit or whether that it's going to be approved by, you know, the UK and England and then what's the Eurozone going to do in response to this? And very complicated. The possible outcomes and the reaction by markets is such that I don't want to be near any of this. You know, if you're an aggressive currency player, probably there's something to be said about looking at the pound and direction potential for the pound if they do a hard Brexit. But I don't know. It doesn't seem like something that I would really want to necessarily get involved with. If you do want to look at this and play this from the long side potentially, because it's been so, you know, thinking that no matter what the outcome is, at least we know what the outcome is. No more confusion, that whole haziness over the situation is lifted. I mean, look at maybe the ETF of England. I think it's EWW. I think it is. Is it EWW? Hmm. Yeah. I'll have to look that up. But anyway, you can find the ETF for the UK and find out maybe you want to play that on the long side. I'm not giving this as a recommendation. I'm really not, because I don't want to be anywhere near this. There's no reason to be near a volcano when it explodes. But once it explodes, kind of all the pressure's off, right? And maybe there's something to be said about getting in at that point when you know right then and there what the result is and direction potential for the markets. And thanks for that question. Let's see. Richard C. Richie. No, right. Richie. Richie C. Long-time listener, first-time question. Thanks for the weekly show and great guests. You're welcome. In the past, you gave some ideas on how to screen for stocks. See, I knew this question was coming up. In the past, you gave some ideas on how to screen for stocks using fundamentals and other metrics. What are your thoughts on TradingView Screener? Any other ideas? Yeah, so I'm a big fan of quantitative analysis, utilizing screeners to do the bulk of the heavy lifting to find stocks that meet a variety of criteria, whether you're looking at technicals and you want to see those that are overbought or oversold, some of those that are dipping below their 50-day moving average, or fundamentals. You want to look at, for example, who is current liabilities versus their long-term liabilities. You want to look at assets versus liability, whatever. I mean, whatever it is. I've looked at the TradingView. Great site, great information, pretty good screener. I like it. The other one I like is FinViz. If you haven't visited that, they have a pretty comprehensive screener available. Yahoo Finance has one. I used to really, really love the Microsoft Money, the MSN Money, but they took it away. They closed the site down. As a matter of fact, I used the MSN Money site as a reference in my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Plug. More plugs. It's available in audio format, by the way. I don't know if you knew this, gang. The Disciplined Investor, my first book, is available in audio format. You can go over to audible.com and grab yourself a copy. Just look up The Disciplined Investor audiobook and you'll find it. But I use the MSN Money, and I will tell you that you could use the concepts in the book or the concepts on the idea of how to use a screener with pretty much any screener out there. Now, some of the components underlying the filters will be different, and you may not be able to get some of the filters that you want. For example, let's say that you're searching for a particular field like, let's go back to this, the assets versus liabilities or current ratio, or maybe you're looking at, short interest, days to cover, I don't know, something like that. Not every screener will have this information available. So try to find the one that has the most robust fields that you can screen on, and possibly use different screeners for different reasons. One thing I'll tell you is this, that obviously the ones I'm mentioning right now are freebies, and you get what you pay for. Who knows if the data's been scrubbed properly, because bad data in is bad data out. So if the data that you're screening on is not accurate or up to date, you may get some wonky answers. But hopefully you could do some checking once you get your information, find out why they made the screen, why a stock didn't make a screen. And, you can keep tracking that and figuring out from different sites what that information may be and why it's different on site to site. So Richie, thanks for your question. Good stuff. Okay. This next question is from Robert G. A little bit long. Hey, Andrew, big fan of your podcast. Thanks so much. Wondering about your thoughts about robotics and automation. It's my understanding the industry is lagging the recovery in tech in part because of the slowing auto industry and lack of capital spending. How the industry will impact a shrinking workforce domestically and the way China is making strides. Topics are okay, ABB, TER, which recently rallied on earnings and exceptional outperformance in the industry. Broad-based funds, which most accurately represent the industry, and it gave me a few different codes on this, are doing all right, but a couple of stocks are overbought. So, robotics, we're in the thick of things when it comes to robotics. It's definitely not a new field anymore, although they have a lot of enhancements and innovation that's going on. A lot of companies are looking for options of installing and bringing on any kind of, we'll call it robotics for lack of a better term, but automation or robotics into their systems, particularly in the manufacturing, warehousing, distribution, retail, and hopefully not in the restaurant business, but probably there too. But a lot of this is already baked in the cake with some of these companies because it's no longer a new field with like a wow factor. It's a field that's here. It's obvious. It's something that's going to go along. And the question is going to be who's got the better product at this point. I think it's a great field. I think it's a great sector. I do think that there will be continuation of opportunity in this area. But realize that, yes, you nailed it when you said that there's a lack of overall spending going on right now because the uncertainties with regard to what's happening with the economy and what's happening particularly with China and the trade deal. Once that lifts, and if that lifts to a positive outcome, you may see a pickup back in the sector again as companies are going to be willing to put some more money down. In addition, the other wild card that you have to consider is if we go and we do see a minimum wage hike across the board, if companies will desire to look for alternatives to paying the extra benefits. Remember something. You don't pay health insurance for a robotic arm in a factory. You don't pay breaks. There's no smoke breaks. There's no sick days. Yes, there's downtime for fixing. But generally speaking, you don't have to worry about an HR department managing the robots. So there is a real appeal to many companies to bring on all sorts of automation in the form of robotics. And that's not going to stop for a long time ahead. And if the efficiency of the robots and if the ability to make sure that the cost factors are low enough, it's going to be a great field for a long period of time. So something to consider. Good question, Robert. We had a great guest on about 2 months ago, 3 months ago. It has to be more than that. Let's see, where are we in July? It has to be, I would say, sometime in March. We had a great guest that talked about this, and I think it was like the robots are coming. Just look on, do a search on the site for the word robots and on the disciplineinvestor.com, and you'll find a pretty cool conversation regarding the whole idea of automation, robotics, autonomous driving, all that. Cool stuff. So I think you're on the right track. But yeah, I mean, companies are probably going to be changing the way they do things as uncertainty prevails, and then probably pick right back up where they were after the fact. So the good news is, with my quick fingers, I did find, it was actually in September, September 9th, The Robots Are Coming with John Pugliano, episode number 578. We talked about this whole discussion. There was also a discussion, as we're looking at this, there was a discussion back in February 2017 where we talked about that upwards about 50% of the your job is being replaced. That was on DH Unplugged, episode number 350, February 22nd, 2017. So there you go. Good stuff on there. And you can find all this information over on the disciplinedinvestor.com. Our next question comes from Mike M. And Mike writes, a few weeks ago, you spoke about negative interest rates in Europe and that it may be impossible for them to get positive again. Couldn't they reduce tax rates? In addition to stimulating the economies, tax decreases will probably create a greater need for borrowing in the short run, which could push up interest rates. Seems like economics 101 to me. Yeah, Mike, the problem is that because of the way that the Eurozone is set up, I mean, fiscal policy is pretty much impossible across the entire region. It's very difficult because, generally speaking, each company has a separate tax rate. Each country has their own governmental tax process. There's VAT taxes. Maybe the Eurozone can change around to do a few things. But again, the problem you have here is that there is this, the Eurozone is a theory, if you will. It's a trading partner process. It's an ease of border flow for goods and services and people and crossings and all that. And at the same time, each country has their own taxation body. And therefore, enabling a fiscal stimulus program is, I don't even know how they could do it. And that's why they haven't done it. So yes, you're right about this, that yeah, reducing taxes would be beneficial, but who is benefited the most? And because you have these cross borders that are so easily, people can either move or transact across so easily, it would probably be unfair for one country or another and cause major problems and disruptions. And that's why it can't be done. So good thought but just not a really good way to do it. But I like your spirit. Next question comes from Tyler G. And he writes, I have recently looked at CEFs, closed-end funds, such as ticker EOI, and I noticed it has consistently outperformed the market over the last several years. Could you explain the concept of CEFs and how they work? Also, the advantages and disadvantages that they come with. So closed-end funds are, first of all, let me kind of describe a little bit about them so you get a better idea, and then talk about some of these other items. It's basically a pooled asset vehicle that can trade at a premium or a discount to the NAV. What happens is an IPO, there's a fixed amount of shares that are put onto the market. And from there, what you have is a pool of assets that are then bought by the fund manager. So let's say there's stocks in there. Well, the stocks have an intrinsic value underlying the portfolio of whatever it is. And the way that it trades on the open market, the closed-end fund, can either be at NAV, above NAV or premium, or below NAV, which is considered a discount. NAV is net asset value. Oh, that's the value of the portfolio. Now, here's the problem. You have a fixed number of shares. Okay. So when you want to buy in or get out, it has to be traded on the open market, as opposed to, let's say, a mutual fund that is constantly creating shares in order to open up the opportunity for people to invest, or when people withdraw, they're retiring shares. Liquidity could be a problem here because they don't have a lot of volume. Look at the volume in some of these closed-end funds. While some will have a decent amount of volume, many of them just don't have a lot of volume that's consequential. And therefore, what you'll find is in market downturns, oftentimes you'll see that they're trading at a significant discount to NAV. Those are times you want to maybe look at these closed-end funds, especially in major market events. When you see these market events happen, what you could do is you could find those that are trading at a significant discount, and if it's something that you want to invest in, look at those. I don't think there is any rhyme or reason, Tyler, why you're seeing this outperformance, unless you're seeing outperformance of an exact measure of a portfolio against a benchmark that is exactly what's invested in the closed-end fund. The one you're talking about here and the one you mentioned, EOI, is an enhanced. It is a, it does more than simply investing in the S&P 500. So it's the strategy that really outperformed there. There's plenty of information on the web about closed-end funds. They're kind of a distant cousin to ETFs in a way, more so than a mutual fund. And they've been around a long time. But basically, it's a pooled asset vehicle with a fixed number of shares that are outstanding, that if you like the strategy, you can invest in it. So that pretty much sums it up on that. Good question. Really good question. Thanks, Tyler. So that about wraps it up for this episode. Thank you so much for all the questions that you gave and provided me. Good content, good information that we shared here today, I think. So basically, I'm over in South Africa right now. Like I said, you can follow me on Dad Bod Food Blog on Instagram. I'll be posting my pictures. There'll be some fun meats, I'm sure, that I'll be eating and checking out. Plus, I have a food tour over in London that I'll be doing the first stop. So check it out. Thanks for joining me. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Make sure to subscribe. Make sure to check all the different strategies we have. Thank you so much for being here. I'll see you maybe next week. It depends when I get back. But either way, have a great week yourselves, and I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.